Hi, y'all. My name is Palmer Graves. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Set my phone out here. I'm really not expecting a call. I set a timer here so that I know that 2.5 hours from now I need to sit down. So, my name is Palmer Graves. I'm very grateful to be here. It is an honor to be here, a privilege to be here, and I would never have expected to be invited back. My home group is the Candle Stepping Up group in Miami, Florida. I also go to an open AA meeting. I go to the Sunset Room, a speaker meeting Sunday night. And I share that because I would not have the program that I have if I didn't attend Alcoholics Anonymous also. I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for sharing the podium at this conference with us. I think that is so important that you you love the family enough to bring them in. And that goes all the way back to 1935 in Akron, Ohio, that tradition of honoring the family and bringing the family into recovery. We are filled in the big book, mention of the family. And if your subject doesn't want this, perhaps the family will. I really strongly believe that alcoholism is a family illness and that we suffer from that spiritual malady as well as does the alcoholic. And I'm so grateful that you've shared the program, the steps, and this just the fellowship with us. Thank you. I'd like to thank Tim and the committee for inviting me. I'm very grateful for that. Jack and Oscar and Roger for picking me up at the airport or gathering up at the airport and coming down here. And I also need to thank the golf buddies, James and Tom and Donna. We had a great time today. I had to take a picture of me, my ball, right on the center line because nobody's going to believe that. It was a chaotic accident that I got in the middle of the fairway. I'm usually way out in either the hinterlands, but I guess once in a while it has to happen, so... Now, we had a great time, and I think that's one of the things about this fellowship is that we absolutely insist on enjoying life, and thank God for that. I came into this fellowship March 5th of 1990, and I came in kicking and screaming, and although I wouldn't make that much noise, I was dying inside, and I needed this fellowship, and I don't know how I got to that point. I grew up in a home where I was loved. I mean, we had everything we needed and then some, and my family loved me. I was not supposed to be born, literally, because my parents were physicists on the Manhattan Project, and both of them were physicists. And my dad underwent a radiation accident in Los Alamos and was never supposed to have been able to have children. And after a while, it settled down, and a few more years, here I came. So my wife accused me of glowing in the dark, so... my older sister came along, she was a Mensa. She's kind of like Keith Lewis's brother, Dumb Denny. My sister, she graduated from high school about 3 years early and went to college and got out of there and, I think a 4.2 grade point average out of 4. I mean, she was just brilliant. And she had one job. After she got her PhD, she had one job. How do you do that? I'm the stupid one in my family. And I can't, my teachers would say, why can't you be like her, meaning my older sister? And I can't, so screw it. I'm the class cut up in the clown, lighting firecrackers in class and getting sent to the principal's office and, stunts like that because I just can't live up to that family. I just knew I was the stupid one in the family. I just was uncomfortable in my own skin. I didn't know how to interact with you. I tell people it's kind of like, when I was to be born, God had us all gathered up that we were going to be born that week. And I had run to the bathroom. I came back after that. And God was saying, and that's all you need to know when you're on earth. I missed the instruction set. I just did not know how to interact with people. And I was full of fear. I mean, it's just fearful. I couldn't be in a room with two people and carry on a discussion because I was afraid. I was just steeped in fear. And I don't know where that came from. I mean, it was just there. I was always less than. I was alone, lonesome, apart from. I didn't know how to be a part of you. You know, that's a great recipe for being an alcoholic. And I tried that. I got drunk at 13, you know, my first time. And I just got blitzed in this church deal in my basement on Colt 45. And, you know, so I do remember my first drunk. You know, I remember it. And yet... I don't feel that power go down to my fingertips. I don't feel that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. What I feel is a dang hangover that just won't quit. You know, my head just boom, boom. And I had to go to church the next day hungover. Now, my friends in AA say you can work through that, Palmer, to get to the good stuff. But I'm a quitter. I mean, you know, it's just... So, you know, I suffer from this ism, this spiritual malady that I am just not okay in my own skin. And I don't know what to do about it, you know. I mean, I thought that drinking would take care of it. It didn't, you know, and it just nothing seemed to work. So I just did it sober, you know, and that's a frightening place to be. I got out of high school, and I guess I did okay because I got in this really small school up in Portland, Oregon that's kind of like the Stanford of the Northwest, I don't know how I got in there, but I did, and I went up there, and you know, I was there for a year and a half, you know, I fell in with this crowd. It was a great group of people. You know, we all had hair down on our backs, and you know, we drank, we went to bars and hung out. We did inhale a lot. And I mean, it was the 70s. You know, that's what you did in the 70s. Or that's what we did. You know, school was optional. So after about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, she went down to Haight-Ashbury. And I don't know who she was. I don't remember now. But I remember chasing a woman down to Haight-Ashbury. And I was living on the streets in Haight-Ashbury. I was one of the hippies in Golden Gate Park and having a good time with that. You know, and the thing is that being around the most loving people that you can imagine, and I get there, and I'm alone, I'm apart from, I'm separate from, and I'm afraid. And I don't know why that is. It's just I've discovered that everywhere I go, there I am, and there I was, and I had all of the isms sitting there in Haight-Ashbury. And so I left Haight-Ashbury, and went to New Mexico and moved into this commune. Outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and we had a great time, you know, and we were just doing what hippies do, but you know, one night we were sitting around talking, about love. That's what hippies did, you know, we love you, and I just mentioned in this moment of honesty or weakness or whatever, I said, you know, I don't feel it, I don't get it. And they picked me up, and they were holding me horizontally, rocking me so that I could feel loved. And I was separate from, I was apart from, I was lonely and lonesome. And I mean, you know, I was just broken. And I still don't know where that came from. It's just, it's not in my upbringing. It's not something that I learned in my family. It's just, I was just a broken human being. And that's where I started. You know, my mom was dying from cancer in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I was going down, you know, either hitchhiking or hopping a freight down to Albuquerque to see her and coming back. And I'd spend as much time with her as I could, but I started getting uncomfortable again. You know, everywhere I am, it just seems like I could go there, somewhere out there, and it'll fix me. I will be okay if I can just get there. You know, the best descriptor I've ever heard is Clancy. He says that somebody snuck in the middle of the night and stuck a spring in his gut, and every night they'd come in and crank it up one notch and one notch, and finally I got so tight he blew. You know, I got to go. And that's what it was like for me. You know, as one day it arrived, it just, you know, that gut was so tight I couldn't stay. I went down to the hospital. I said, "Mom, I gotta go. I'm out of here. Sorry. I'm gone." And she said, "Okay, bye." And I hugged her and told her I love her, and I left. I didn't know that I was selfish and self-centered. I didn't know that was the root of my trouble. All I knew is that I just had to get out because somewhere out there I would be okay. And so we left and went across the country to Virginia Beach and living on the beach doing what hippies do. And after about 3 or 4 weeks or a month maybe, the state police came and found me and they said, "Call home." And so I called home and they were just coming in from Mom's funeral. I wasn't there. I wasn't a son, I wasn't a brother, I wasn't a nephew. I wasn't there for my family where I was supposed to be. You know, I was out doing stuff, looking for me, you know, selfish, self-centered. And I didn't know that's what it was. I didn't have that label yet. So I went home and I was taking care of stuff at the house in Los Alamos, and I was playing music in a coffee house, and a street musician, and a potter, and because I was not going to do science, by God, that's my rebellion, you know. So I was playing music and being a potter, and not doing very well at it. But I was at this coffee house. Now, for the youngins, that's not Starbucks. Although it's not that different. The only real big difference is we didn't have Wi-Fi. But I was playing music, and she walked in the door, and you know she got my attention. I'm back up a minute. The reason I tell my story this way is, you know, there's no mention of alcoholism. I'd not been touched by alcoholism, and yet, as you can plainly tell, I'm crazy as a loon, and I have to remember that I am my qualifier in Al-Anon. You know, I don't qualify for Al-Anon because I marry alcoholic women. I marry alcoholic women because I qualify for Al-Anon. You know, I suffer from this spiritual malady, and the steps and this fellowship are a solution to that malady from which I suffer. Anyway, back to the coffee house. I was playing music, and she walked in. And, boy, she got my attention, and I went up. I played two more songs and went up and started talking to her. And the next thing I knew, you know, we began this courtship. And, 5 minutes later, we moved in together. You know, my sponsor says that after 5 minutes, you know everything you need to know. Why wait? And But so we were moving in together in the back of the coffee house. And, you know, the remarkable thing was when I was with her, I felt this immediate sense of ease and comfort that came from being with her. I did feel the power coming down to my fingertips. I felt at once comfortable in my own skin. And I'd never experienced that before. And I was to chase that feeling to the gates of insanity and death because I wanted that to come back where she was working for me. It was an incredibly important experience for me to be okay and comfortable in my own skin. However, Los Alamos wasn't working for her and wasn't working for me, so we left and I went up to Oregon, and I cut the lodge poles. We set up this mansion on the side of Mount Hood, my teepee, and began living there. And it was a magical place to live. It was an amazing time living out on the side of Mount Hood. And it was wonderful. It was incredible, and it lasted for about 3 weeks. And then it stopped working. You know, and I decided, well, we got to go to Eastern Oregon, and we went over there. And there I did have my first brush with alcoholism. My sister-in-law came and lived with us and for a short time, left her kids on our doorstep and moved downtown Redmond, Oregon, and got a job as a barmaid. And, you know, barmaid is a great gig for an alcoholic woman because they can drink all they want to for free. Well, you know, there's some costs and prices that they have to pay, but it's worth it for the alcohol. And I was bewildered. I had never seen anybody drink with that intensity and to that degree before. And I was bewildered. Frankly, I didn't know what was going on. And I tried to adjust her drinking, talk to her. I mean, it didn't work. And so it was just crazy. And one Sunday, you know, the kids were in there with her, and she was out bleeding out of a slit wrist, and they were out in the street screaming, and we got her help. And, and, And I took her into a detox Bend, Oregon. You know, I didn't know that that was alcoholism. Nobody had told me about alcoholism, and it's bewildering for the family. But we got her patched up, and I had my first introduction to you. They have these weird half sentences on the wall, you know, like easy does it, and like I'm going, easy does what, you know, and let go and let God. Yeah, that's a helpful one, you know. And but I noticed that Bobby Jo got sober, and she came out of that you know, it wasn't a treatment center. It was a detox center. They just, you know, you jitter it out. But she came out, and she had the big book. We were on the second edition back then. And I was just enamored with that book. It was incredible. And so I'd sit around with Bobby Jo and read that book, and I fell in love with it. And Bobby Jo sobered up for a time. I didn't know she went back out, but she did. But it was my introduction to AA. Nobody said, Palmer, you need to go to Al-Anon. I know Al-Anon existed in 1972 or 3 in Oregon. It was, 22 years old at the time. But I wouldn't have gone anyway. I mean, you know, if they'd have said go, I mean, she's got the problem. Thank you very much. I'm fine. And so, but... You know, Oregon stopped working. So we moved down to eastern Oklahoma, and I got this little subsistence farm, and I was there working with my father-in-law who raised and trained cutting horses. And, I mean, he was just magical with horses, and I loved working with him. He was a strong guy, and not particularly big, but he was really a giant in my eyes. And I worked with him learning about horses, and one day he disappeared. And I found him about 2 months later down in Poto, Oklahoma, in a flop house. You know, he was pasty gray, a shell of the man he had been. And he said, Palmer, take me to detox. And so I was going to take him 1 hour out to McAllister, Oklahoma, and drop him in detox. But before we left Poto, he said, get me a beer. And I'm saying, why am I going to buy you a beer? I'm taking you to detox. And he let me know and made me understand that he was seeing things that I didn't see. He was experiencing things crawling all over him that I didn't see, you know. And he was having DTs, and he needed a beer. And so I got him a beer and took him to detox. Again, I see y'all. You know, and those slogans on the wall, and the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous working through a detox center, it was amazing. You know, my wife started drinking and drugging, and I didn't really find that to be a problem. I just went with her. I mean, you know, I'm not one of those Al-Anons that never touched a drop of liquor, you know. I was right there in the middle of it, you know. I'd go up. We had this one place that we went, Turkey Creek Saloon. It was so far back in the mountains it didn't even have electricity. You know, it had to generate it with Honda generators. And back there you could buy moonshine, you could buy Budweiser beer, you could buy anything else you wanted, dry goods, you know, whatever you wanted, it was there. And I was glad to participate in all that. I was glad to sit up there and drinking moonshine, playing music. But, you know, I started having to do things. You know, my wife would get into stuff that she shouldn't ought to get into. And you know, she required watching. You know, and so I'd go up there and hang out watching her to make sure she wouldn't get into trouble. And you know, that gets pretty crazy. I remember one time David Allan Coe was going to play up there. And, you know, he's an outlaw musician. He attracts some frightening crowds of people. Well, she was going to be a barmaid that night, so I signed on as security. The only problem with that is I'm kind of a wimp. I mean, you know what? You know, what am I going to do? Go up to some guy and say, you know, gee, sir, would you please put your gun away? You know, and I would place myself in a position to be harmed because I had to watch her. And I had to watch her because in my experience, she had gotten into things that she shouldn't ought to have gotten into. I mean, you know, when I first read the chapter to wives, I hated that chapter. And I would have told you at the time I hated this chapter because it's antiquated, and by God, doesn't he know that there are men that live with alcoholics? And that wasn't why. The reason I hated it was that it just seems like Bill Wilson, when he wrote it, was looking in my bedroom window watching us. And because it described my home, and I just couldn't face what was going on. I you know, we went to counseling, and you know, they call it couples therapy now, I guess. But you know, we would talk to this counselor, but I've got this need to maintain this facade. You know, I can't let him know that she's drinking and drugging because, I mean, my God, what would he think? So I didn't know what to say, and she was, you know, she told him over and over again at great length that she drank and whatever because of what I did or didn't do. It was my fault, and I believed her, and he said that I did, and he said I needed to be on some sort of medication or drugs because I was crazy. Well, he's right. I was crazy, but, you know, I couldn't tell him what was going on. I started doing things at home and, you know, driving by the bars to see where she was and driving by his house to see if she was there. And I never felt very good about the answers because usually, yes, she was. And you know, it's just, it talks about the life of the despairing wives and the children. And you know, that was what was going on. And my own was a despairing husband. I was pitiful. You know, but I was really good at being poor, pitiful Palmer. You know, people would come and ask me, how are you doing? I said, oh, I'm okay. You know, I don't know what it fed in me, but I could be and act that pitiful person so that I could gather or garnish your sense, your sympathy. When I talked about, you know, the affairs, well, the retaliatory affairs happened too that it talks about in there. And you know, it was not a good, healthy home for me or my wife or my child. You know, it was just an alcoholic home. I remember one time, you know, she was going up to the lake and I was stuck working on the farm and she took the truck and went up about sundown, I had no defense against the first thing. I had to know what she was doing. And you know, she had the truck, so what do I do? I don't know, you know. So I jumped on my tractor, and I went do this drive-by sighting on my tractor. And you know, the funny thing is that, you know, my tractor didn't have a muffler, and didn't have headlights, and I was going up over these hairpin turns, down over the mountain, down to the other side. When I got up to the lake, because it didn't have a muffler, if they were there, they heard me coming from a quarter mile away. I thought I was doing a sneaky drive-by sighting. And I got up there and there was nobody there. Now, for all I know, they could have been hiding out in the brush laughing at me because there I was, you know, on this tractor and everything. You probably like this one, Roger, a tractor story. But anyway, so I get back in my tractor, drive back over the mountain and down. And you know, when I found they weren't there, it was like, oh, okay. And I was relieved, and I went home. You know, it never occurred to me at the time, well, where is she? You know, I didn't think about that. I was just nuts. You know, when you have to maintain this facade that everything's okay, you have to cut out friends. You know, you can't have a lot of friends because they'll know what's going on in my home. And somehow to me, it just seemed like if I admitted there was alcoholism in my home, I would be, you know, less of a man somehow or, you know, judged harshly. I didn't really know, but I wouldn't admit. We had one set of friends left, and they invited us to come in and see a movie. And we went in Friday night, or we were going to, and she said, Palmer, I don't want to go. Don't feel well. And I said, well, I'll stay. And she said, no, you go. So I left and went to watch this movie on TV at their house. And it was, you know, one of those Friday the 13th. I don't know. It's not my genre. And I wasn't really thinking about the movie because I was wondering what she was doing, with whom she was doing it, what's going on at the house. So anyway, when the movie was done, I went home. And when I got home, you know, started up to the door, and a rifle stuck out the door, and she said, get the hell out, and don't you ever come back. And I was like, I just went to see a movie, but I got out. I mean, you know, that's terrifying. And I left. I went, drove off down to Arkansas, and And I was down there for about 3 weeks, and her lawyer got a hold of me and said, you need to come in. She's suing for divorce, and we need to meet. So I went up to Wilburton, Oklahoma, and I was going to go to the lawyer's office. And I got there, and she was there. And she said, Palmer, I don't know what was wrong with me that day. Please come home. I love you, and I need you. I know, you know, for the out on that, I need you. It's kind of like a mainline shot for a junkie, you know. And so I went home. I mean, you know, I fired my lawyer on the spot. Of course I would go home. She needed me. Now, you know, it never occurred to me, you know, a normal person might perhaps think twice about going home to a person who 3 weeks previously had been holding a gun on him. You know, right over my head. That never occurred to me. And I moved home. And, you know, once the family starts sliding downhill, it's inevitable. It just goes one direction, and that's downhill. And it just got worse, and it got worse. And I didn't know what to do. And I finally decided that, now this is a newcomer plan. Realize that newcomer plans are absolutely insane. But I decided that I would go back to school. I had a high school diploma because, remember, I'm the stupid one in the family. But I was going to go back and get a degree in science education. So I went back and I entered the University of Oklahoma. I know, wrong university here, but that's where I went. And I was going to school. I'd leave Monday morning at 4:30, commute up, and I'd come back Thursday or Friday, depending on my class schedule. And I worked for a year, I finished up my bachelor's in science education. But the reason that I did that was that I thought that if I got my teaching certification, I could go to work as a teacher. And what a great gig. You know, you don't go in until, what, 10, 10:30 in the morning. And yeah, if you're a teacher, don't listen to this, you know. And you have to come home about 2 o'clock in the afternoon and work, you know, you get your summers off. And, you know, I just thought, what an easy job. I can do that and take care of her. You know, insanity. I would be leaving the university, driving back to the farm, and I would go into these periods I call my Al-Anon brownouts. I would drive for an hour and a half, absolutely mentally obsessed with what she was doing, what was the fight going to be about that day, and all of a sudden I'd come to, and I was an hour and a half down the road. I have no memory of the drive. You know, that's frightening because I don't know, I could have killed somebody while I was just moving down the road, not even aware of where I was. Literally like a blackout for the alcoholic. You know, it's the mental obsession, the obsession of the mind taking me down the road, not even aware of where I was going or what I was doing. I'd walk in the house and I'd say, what's the fight going to be about today? Well, you know, later in fourth step inventory, I found out, who started the fight? I did. But I didn't know that at the time. It took a lot of inventory. My mother-in-law came down, and she said, Palmer, is she drinking a lot? Is she drugging? And I said, no, Mom, she's fine. Thank you very much. We're both fine. And she said, no, Palmer, you're acting weird. What she knew was there's a piece of our literature in the One Day at a Time book that says that it's often easier to spot an alcoholic home by the actions of the spouse and the children than it is by the actions of the alcoholic. You know, she covered it up fine. In fact, she was fine. Drinking is her solution. I was crazy, and I made my son crazy, and, you know, just the home was crazy. But I couldn't admit to my mother-in-law that there was alcoholism in my home because, I mean, my God, I've got to maintain that facade. What would she think? And she said, Palmer, I need to tell you a story. There was a lady that lived with a bad drunk, and she kept going to him and saying, what can I do? Is there anything I can do to stop you from drinking? And he said, finally one day, he said, yeah, you know, I think if you go dig a dozen worms and bring them in and fry them, I could eat those worms, and that'll help me to stop drinking. Well, gosh, you know, there's a solution. We'll do anything. So she went out, and she found a dozen choice fat worms, brought them up, breaded them, fried them up, put them on a platter and, you know, brought them into him. And he said, you eat half. Well, you we'll go to any lengths too. And so she cut him in half and ate half, and he went and got a bottle of bourbon, proceeded to get drunk, and she's spluttering, going, why? I mean, I dug the worms, I ate the worms, and now you're getting drunk. And he said, yeah, you ate the wrong half. You know, when I heard that story, I burst into tears, because that was my first step moment. I understood that I'm absolutely powerless over alcohol, that every time I get in the ring with alcohol, I lose. Every time I get in and try to modify her drinking, I lose. That I'm absolutely nothing that I can do. And my mother-in-law said, Palmer, you've got to go to Al-Anon. You've got to go to Al-Anon. So I kept driving back up to Norman from the farm, and about 3 weeks later, one Thursday, we had this bitter, wicked fight over the telephone, and I was just crushed. I didn't know what to do. You know, it's like at that moment in time, there was no friendly direction that I could turn. I couldn't live with her. I couldn't live without her. You know, I was at that jumping off point, and I didn't know what to do. And so I looked in the phone book for Al-Anon, and I couldn't find it. Yes, it's there, but I didn't find it. I found AA, and I called you. I guess, you know, it's easier to spell, probably. I don't know. But I found Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called them. And I'm so grateful for places that have family recovery, because when I called, he knew what to say. And he talked to me for a few minutes, asked me the questions. And he said, Palmer, I've got somebody I want you to talk to. And he handed the phone to one of the Al-Anon ladies. And Doris took the phone, and she listened to me blubbering and whining and crying. And, you know, and she said, Palmer, I think we can help you. You need to come in. And they met Sunday, Monday, and Wednesday at that time at that group. And I went home for the weekend and came back on Monday, March 5th of 1990. I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. And the feeling was just absolutely amazing. For the first time in my life, I was comfortable. I was home. I didn't understand the feeling, but I knew I was home and safe. They told me the three C's at that time. They said, Palmer, you didn't cause it, you can't cure it, and you can't control it. And that was the most remarkable piece of information for me, because I knew from experience, I knew from being with a counselor, I knew from over and over and over again talking to her that I had caused her to drink and to be what she was. And they said, no, Palmer, if she's an alcoholic, she drank because she's an alcoholic. You can't do anything about that. But they also told me, Palmer, but we have a program here for you. You don't have to live this way if you don't want to. And that got my attention. And so I became an Al-Anon. And I started going every time the doors opened, I was there. I'm so grateful for those old women. And I say women, and I say old women. They're probably 15 years younger than I am right now, but at that time it seemed old. And there were no men in Al-Anon at all, which really, again, is not true, but it's my perception. I have all these old ideas that I need to get rid of. But that was one of them, that it was just women in Al-Anon. And one of the old-timers pulled me aside because I was starting to say, you guys don't get it. You don't understand. I'm different. I'm a man in Al-Anon, and y'all are women, and you don't get it. And she took me aside, you know, loving, you know, the finger in your chest kind of loving, and said, Palmer, listen for similarities, not differences. And I did, and these women were telling my story. It is the family disease of alcoholism. And I hear today a lot of people saying, you know, well, I was an adult child of an alcoholic, or I was married to an alcoholic, or my kids are an alcoholic. I don't think it matters. We suffer from the family disease. Now, that's my opinion. It is not anything but that. So take it as you, if you will. But, you know, if I get the flu, I really don't care where I caught the bug. It could be at school, at the store, at the train station. It doesn't matter. If I catch the flu, I take the medicine. If I have the Al-Anon family-ism, I can take the steps, and that's the medicine. It doesn't matter who the alcoholic was. It matters who I am and with the solution for my malady. But anyway, so I was there, and that's what they were telling me, and so I started coming back. But these women would meet me at the door and hug me. Now, I got to tell you, I looked a lot like Charlie Manson at the time. You know, I had hair down my back and a scruffy beard. Bathing was optional when you're so freaked out about what she's doing or not doing or all of that. You know, I didn't bathe as often as I might, so I kind of smelled bad and looked scary. No light in my eyes, and yet they met me at the door. They hugged me and welcomed me, and when I left, they hugged me and said, "Palmer, you keep coming back. We need you." And I'm saying, "Well, if you need me, I guess, you know, I can fit it in my schedule." Not long after that, there was a guy that came through town and through the meeting. And you know, he'd been hiding out at a different meeting. I mean, who knew? But there were men in Al-Anon, and I asked him to sponsor me. And he listened to me whine. And just before I'd asked him to sponsor me, I was down at the farm. It was about 3 months after I'd started coming to Al-Anon. And she was standing over me with a butcher knife one night. I was laying on a cot, and she said, "Palmer, you got to go to sleep, and when you do, you're a dead man." And I had reached this state of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I just didn't care. I just rolled over and went to sleep. I woke up in the morning, obviously, she didn't do whatever she threatened to do. I mean, maybe she was messing with me. I don't know what her story is, but I woke up in the morning and I realized I had attempted suicide that night by just rolling over and going to sleep. That pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, you know, I just didn't care. I didn't know what to do. I just could not stay in this pain any longer. And I didn't know where to go. I had asked the people in this meeting over and over and over again, "Do I stay? Do I go? What do I do?" And they say, "We don't know. But when you know, you'll know. But right now you don't know, so you don't know. Don't do anything. You can make a decision to not make a decision. And when you know, you'll know." And I'm just like, what are you talking about? But that morning I woke up and I knew. You know, I was just done. I had to leave, and I left the farm, I left my dog, I left my son, I left my wife, and I just left. And I got back up to Norman, and I lived out of my pickup for a few days, homeless, no, nothing. I had a guitar, an extra pair of jeans, an extra shirt, and that's about all I had. And I got up to Norman, I moved in with a couple of friends who had just come out of a halfway house, and of course, who else am I going to find? And so I was going to meetings, and so when this guy came through and I asked him to sponsor me, you know, he'd been listening to me whining about whatever it was, the whine of that day was, and he said, "Palmer, I want you to go home and get a piece of paper, and I want you to write one thing for which you're grateful." And so I wanted to say, you know, "Have you not been listening to me? You know, she and I." And of course, that's not what I said. What I said was, "Yes, sir." And I went home and I started thinking, and I mean, I just tried for a couple hours to come up with something for which I could feel grateful. And I couldn't find anything. Finally, all I could write on that piece of paper was, "I'm grateful. I only have to write one damn thing on my gratitude list." And that's what I wrote. And so I took it back to my sponsor, and I knew, well, this is going to fix this thing. He'll realize the error of his ways and the stupid assignment and do something different. And I gave it to him, and he looked at it and said, "Now, that's great. I want you to write two things." I was like, "What?" And I went home, and it was two things, and then it was five things, and then it was 10 things. And I wrote really stupid, lame things. "I'm grateful I have a shower. I'm grateful I have a trash can." I mean, I don't know, but in 2 weeks, I noticed a change in my life. I was suddenly feeling grateful. I had my guitar. I had an extra pair of jeans. I had my pickup truck. I had an extra shirt. And I was grateful. Nothing in my life had changed except for my perception of my life and my attitude about life. And it all came about from taking the actions suggested by my sponsor and doing something that I thought, yeah, right, this will work. I mean, I didn't have to believe. I just had to take the action, and I did that, and it worked. I was feeling grateful. And And so we started through the steps. And the first step was just not a big reach for me. You know, I had managed myself into a state of homelessness. Every time I get in the ring with alcoholism, I have my butt kicked. And I can't manage it. And I'm just, I'm done. And so the first step wasn't a big deal. The second step, however, is a left-handed admission of our own insanity. Because I told him, I said, I'm not insane, Frank. I thank you very much. And he stopped a minute and he said, Palmer, tell me, what was that tractor deal? It's like, oh, yeah, And I had told him some other things that I had done, in a moment of insanity, And he could point out to me that my life had been totally insane. You know, I kept trying the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, and every time it wouldn't work, but I'd try it again. Maybe this time it'll be different. Maybe this time it'll work. All of that stuff that's insanity. And then he took me into the third step. And it's like I saw it on your walls, guys. I knew it was there. And you can disguise this by HP or higher power or whatever. But I know you're talking about God. And I'm sorry, I don't do God. And I told him that. I said, I don't do God. And he took me into the chapter, We Agnostic. And in there it says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. I'm right there, man. I'm doing this debate. Do I go back to the farm, the butcher knife, the gun, or do I stay here and do this spiritual crap with you? I'm debating. I don't know, I didn't know. I mean, it was kind of like, would that knife hurt? And he took me further in the book. It says, do you believe or are you willing to believe in a power greater than yourself? And I could say, unequivocally, no, I don't believe. But that part, are you willing to believe? I saw you guys, you're happy, cutting up, laughing, joking, and having a great time, and this is what you did. Am I willing? Yeah, I don't know, maybe. Maybe, yeah, I guess just a tiny bit willing. I might be willing to believe in something that you're talking about. And he said, that's all you need. That's it. So we knelt down together, held hands, and said the third step prayer. I still love that prayer today. I love that prayer. Now, it wasn't magical. The earth didn't shake. I didn't get this magical feeling at all at that time. Well, at once, one thing changed, because somehow or other, he believed when it says that this step is of little permanent value unless at once followed by rigorous action, he thought that meant I had to start a fourth step right then. And so we did. And I did the fourth step. I had the three columns, and I listed resentments, all the people against whom I felt resentment, people, places, institutions, ideas, things. And I didn't mind that. I had hundreds of different resentments. And I loved writing the second column about what you did that I resented. I couldn't get very wordy because he said keep it real short. And then, that stuff about, what was its cause? I didn't like that so much, but I really didn't like it when he turned the page and it said, referring to our list again, we looked at where were we at fault, because then it wasn't fun anymore. But I looked at that, and, I had hundreds of different resentments, and when I started filling in my fourth column, it turned out I had four resentments hundreds of times. It all came back to my defects of character. And it was so clear to me that all that I had done to sabotage this relationship, that my marriage that ended, we were divorced by then, but I was seeing that where I was wrong. I don't even want to say what my part was. It was, where was I wrong? And I started seeing that. I'm a people pleaser. I've never been successful at that, but I would tell people when they'd ask me to do something, I'd say yes, and they'd say okay, and I get a resentment. Don't you know I mean no when I say yes, but I'm too afraid to say no because you might not like me. And so I'd resent you for believing me when I said yes when I meant no. I mean, if you're confused, you're probably in the right room. But you know, it was just bizarre. And so, but the neat thing about that was that I started to see that I am my qualifier, that I am the one that has these character defects that are making my life miserable. And because I have these defects of character, I can see very clearly that there is a solution for me and what's wrong with me, this spiritual malady from which I suffer. And so we went to the fifth step, and, you know, it's by God, I didn't want to do the fifth step because I knew that if he knew, then Al-Anon would certainly soon know everything that I had done wrong and the true nature of my being, which was ugly and unacceptable, and you would take this vote where you do these secret votes and decide that, you know, Palmer, I know we said that anybody can come to Al-Anon, but we're going to have to draw a line here. I'm sorry, you're not acceptable. That's what I thought. And he laughed at me. He said, you know, yeah, Palmer, I did that, and you should have seen what I did. And he started telling me all the things that he had done, and I found out that I'm just a garden variety Al-Anon. There's nothing which separates me from you, from him, from anybody else. And at the end, he said, yeah, Palmer, I love you. And you know, I wasn't rejected. I wasn't thrown to the curb because I'm just one of y'all. And I knew that through the fifth step. I really did start to have that spiritual transformation then. I remember going on to the sixth and seventh step, and I was in a room this one time, and there were about 10 people in the room, and I was absolutely comfortable in my own skin, and I was comfortable with you, and I was laughing and joking and having cutting up and having a good time. And something seemed wrong, so I stepped aside to see what was wrong. And what it was I was comfortable. It felt wrong because I had never experienced that. But I could be with you. Somewhere when I was back doing this stupid stuff like gratitude lists and inventories and all the other stupid sponsorship directions, I was focused over here and it was fixed over here, like Tim Williams used to say. You know, it's like, we don't know what's going to happen, but while you're over there, it's happening over here. And it absolutely did. Jimmy Williams, sorry, not Tom Williams. But you know, it was neat. Now, my sponsor quit at that time. He disappeared. I don't know where he went. I never saw him again. And I thought, well, I can sponsor myself. I've been in the program about 2 years, you know. And yeah, you've done a bad, bad decision. And I started getting sicker, and I realized that I was. And I asked another guy to sponsor me, and we started through the steps again. But the other thing that happened was I started dating this Earth gal, and you know, she was just really a neat woman, and she didn't understand about the program. She didn't understand my need for Al-Anon, but she was okay with me going. You know, she said, that's fine, you can go. And she'd make space in our evening relationships for me to go, you know, cut out and go to Al-Anon, and it was pretty neat. And we continued to court each other, and about a year and a little bit later, we got married, and then got out on the honeymoon, and it was like, God, she drinks a lot. And, boy, did she drink a lot, you know. And I was up at Canyon Conference with I was sitting in a golf cart with my grand sponsor. Some of you knew Pat Clater and Jack Clater, but Pat was my grand sponsor. And I was sitting in this golf cart with her, and I said, Pat, I think I've married another alcoholic. And she put her hand around me and just hugged me tight. And she said, son, sometimes I think their horns just fit the holes in our head. And, you know, I needed to hear that. Y'all are the first people I've ever encountered that say it's okay to love an alcoholic. And I do. I love alcoholics. And, you know, I love hanging out with you in recovery a lot better than in the drink. But nonetheless, you know, it just, I resonate with alcoholics. And Pat was giving me permission, and that's okay. And yeah, my wife did drink. And I was going to school. Actually, I'd graduated with my bachelor's, and I was still taking a class in the department, and the chair came, our associate chair came up and said, Palmer, we want you to go take a test tomorrow. I said, okay, I can do that. And I don't know what it is, but I went over to the field house and sat down in 8 hours or 6 hours of test. I don't know. It was rigorous. And I left. And about 3 weeks later, the scores came back in. And it happened to be the GRE test. And when my scores came in, he called me in. He said, Palmer, we want to offer you a fellowship. They were going to offer me. They were offering to pay me to go to graduate school. I said, can I think about it? And he said, sure, but do it. And that was a dilemma. I'm the stupid one in my family, and I can't do graduate school. And the other thing is that I'm old. I mean, I was in my 30s, and I'm too old to graduate school. I heard Clint Hodges from the Pacific Group talking, and Clint had been offered a trip to law school, and he went to his sponsor, and he said, do you know how old I'll be in 5 years if I go to law school? And Clancy looked at him and said, well, Clint, tell me, how old are you going to be in 5 years if you don't go to law school? that slapped me upside the head, and it was like, oh, okay. And so I went to the University of Oklahoma in graduate school, and I started working with my sponsor. I was going to meetings at night and working during the day, one day at a time, one class at a time, one test at a time, one paper at a time, just doing the next indicated right thing, which is what my sponsor had told me to do, what y'all had told me to do. I kept working and working, and my wife was going downhill. She was drinking, blackout drinking, going crazy, And I was just doing what I did one day at a time. I remember one time I came home my dog, we had this little miniature schnauzer. I mean, they're tough, but they're little. She met me at the door, and she would not let me go in the kitchen and set my backpack down. She took me upstairs, made me go upstairs, and she was snorting around the bathroom door. And I finally, I'm slow. I got the idea, and I kicked the door down, and my wife was dying on the floor. And, she'd written a suicide note in lipstick on the mirror. Very dramatic. So I called 911, took her into the hospital, they put her on lockdown, and the next day they ran out of beds, and so the shrink called me and said, you're going to have to come get her, and I said, I don't want her. I mean, it wasn't that I was mad at her, didn't want her. It was like what I told him. I said, I've got absolutely no expertise in dealing with this. I don't know what to do with her. And he said, whatever you're going to do tomorrow, just do it. Just come get her and take her to do whatever you're doing. So I said, okay. So I was going to go play golf that day while she was in lockdown. So I took her to play golf. She'd never been golfing. She figured out to say four before she hit the ball instead of after. But it was, while she was at 911, she was in the hospital on a breathing machine. We didn't know whether she was going to live or die. And I called y'all, and you came in, and we had a meeting. And our opening says that we can be happy whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. And I knew that that was absolutely true. It's not that I was unmoved. She was dying in a hospital bed while I was out having a meeting in the ICU waiting room. But I knew that I was okay. If she'd lived, I was fine. If she died, I would be sad, but I would be fine because I was among you. I was in the middle of Al-Anon and middle of AA, and it was just I knew I was okay. I scared her sober for about a year, and she came out, and she asked me to take her to an AA meeting. I took her and put her in y'all's hands and went to an Al-Anon meeting. I mean, I can't sponsor her, and thank goodness I know that. She did pretty good. I went to continued to school, a year later, life happened, and she had no defense against the first drink, and in 2 months she was back on a breathing machine. That time I didn't call 911. I just threw her over my shoulder and put her in the van and took her myself. But again, she was on a breathing machine. Didn't know if she was going to live or die. Our opening says that we will be happy whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. And I can guarantee you that, I mean, I've lived with alcoholism with me having a program, and I've lived with alcoholism with me having no program, and I know that having a program helps me to put up with active alcoholism, and that I can live content, useful, and usefully whole if I just continue to stay in the middle of the fellowship, and I did. They kicked me out of the University of Oklahoma with a PhD in chemistry. You know, and I don't know how that happens. I don't know how you go from a homeless person, you know, Charlie Manson-y kind of a guy, to a PhD in chemistry. And, I mean, there's no road from there to there. It just doesn't exist. But through you, sponsorship, the steps, and a relationship with a loving God that I just can't describe, I was transported from somewhere where I started to where I ended up. And I absolutely know today that that's a God working in my life. I got an offer to go down to and accepted a job on the faculty at a university in Florida. And I now today teach at Florida International University in Miami. And I love what I do. You know, I just go out every day to take care of God's kids. And you know, it's amazing. And while I was down there, I needed to make amends. You know, I was on the eighth and ninth step, and of course, the first person who's on my list was my mother. I'd abandoned her dying as well as broken her heart. And so I, again, Clint Hodges talked about going to the grave and reading a letter and cleaning up the grave. And when I heard him, I flew out to Los Alamos, and I sat at the grave, read this letter to my mom, and cried and talked to her and cleaned up the gravesite and cried some more. And, I spent a couple of hours with my mom at the gravesite. I had contempt prior to investigation. I mean, I did not believe that, reading a letter at the gravestone is going to be, you know, that's useful. But again, I know to do the action suggested by my sponsor. And I did. And so I left the gravesite and I did feel cleaned out. But the first person I ran into was my mother's dearest friend. And Becky said, "Palmer, what were you doing today?" And I said, "Becky, I was just hanging out." And she said, "No, Palmer, what were you doing today?" And it was bizarre. I said, "Becky, I was hanging out." And she said, "No, really, Palmer, what were you doing?" And her question was crazy. It was drilling. She would not accept that answer. Finally, I said, "Becky, I needed to make amends to Mom. You know, I'd broken her heart. I'd abandoned her dying of cancer." And Becky started laughing. And, you know, that's not what I expected, but she was just laughing at me. And she said, "Palmer, I was with your mother the day that you left. And she was overjoyed that you were leaving because she didn't want you to witness her dying." You know, I don't know what the odds are that I'm going to go make an amend that I really didn't believe would work. And I come out of the canyon, and the first person that I'm going to run into was my mother's dearest friend. And just, boom, the guilt was lifted. I had that ninth step experience that says that I knew that God was doing for me at that moment what I could not do for myself. Absolutely, because I could not have done that. And yet I can see God working in my life. You know, that's a remarkable statement from this guy at the third step. Says, "No, wait a minute, man, I don't do God," to somebody who absolutely knows that God is working in my life. I was accused of being part of the God Squad at a meeting about 5 years ago. I was talking something about God, and this girl in the meeting said, "Yeah, you're one of those God Squad people." And all I could say was, "Well, thank you." But she didn't mean it as a compliment. But. It's absolutely true that I today have a relationship with a God of my understanding. And I didn't, you know, I didn't come to Al-Anon to find that. I mean, I came, whatever you can do, I just want to quit hurting. And you suggested that I want a relationship with a God. And I thought you were absolutely nuts. You know, what do I want with that? And yet, that has been the solution to my problem. You know, our 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I was at this meeting one time, and there were a couple of people talking about their white light experience, and I called my sponsor, and with some resentment and some heat, I said, "When am I going to have my spiritual experience?" And you know, you could hear him flopping around on the floor. He was laughing so hard. And that's one of those statements you can't unsay, you can't reel it back in. And when he was done laughing, he came back on the phone. He said, "Palmer, I want you to think back to what it was like 2 weeks before you came into Al-Anon. And I started thinking about what I was, and that sense of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and that looking at the knife and just rolling over and going to sleep. Who cares? To what I am today and what I was at that day when he posed this question for me. And there is just absolutely no comparison. And I realized that, yes, I have had this spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Al-Anon likes to tell frog stories, and I don't know what it is, but we tell this story about when you throw a frog in a pot of boiling water, they'll jump out. But if you throw them in a cold pot of water and incrementally, slowly turn up the heat, they will stay there and boil to death. I think that that's how we get into this disease, one little bit at a time. And as the heat turns up, we look at it and say, this isn't that bad. I think I can do this. I can do that. No, I can do that. And pretty soon we're boiling to death and we don't know how we got there. And I think that the spiritual awakening, the educational variety of a spiritual awakening, is much the same. It is slowly over time we get a little more awakened until, wow. And the only way I could see that was thinking, you know, what I was 2 weeks before I came to Al-Anon, what I am today, and I can see that transformation then. And I absolutely have had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I probably ought to get my wife sober here. She moved down to Florida with me and could not stay sober. And finally, we were fixing a Thanksgiving dinner for our kids, and she got drunk and passed out. And I had to call my sponsor twice that day. I had a resentment, if you want to believe it or not. But it was okay. I put the dinner together and fed the kids, and she came stumbling downstairs, you know, at some point and ate, and she sobered up about, I don't know, 4 months after that. And we were speaking together as a couple in recovery at this meeting anniversary, and she was telling this story about one Thanksgiving. We were making dinner for my kids, and I got drunk and passed out. And that was, I felt so helpless and powerless that was my bottom, and I redoubled my efforts and went to AA. And she's sober. She's a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous today with 18 years sobriety. But, you know, that the two stories are so fundamentally different. I had to call my sponsor twice because I had this resentment, and she was hitting her bottom. What I had prayed for was happening, and I didn't see it. I know today that God is really, really smart about this stuff, and if I will just let it unfold, it is so much better than anything that I could imagine or engineer on my own. And that's true. I mean, Gayla is a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't say that lightly. We have a home where, you know, she'll be back in the bedroom talking to her sponsees, and I'm up front talking to mine, or I'm working with a bunch of guys in the big book, and, you know, she's going to meetings. I mean, it's just, it worked for us, and we're doing this deal together. And I'm so grateful and thankful to you for that. I was at a meeting. It was a funeral for a friend of mine who her father had died, and I was there to support her. While I was there, the minister was talking about grace. And afterwards, I was thinking about it. I have no clue what grace means. And so I looked it up in Webster's Dictionary. I know that's not conference-approved literature, but... it says that grace is unmerited divine assistance given man for his sanctification or regeneration. I've done absolutely nothing to earn what you have given me. I mean, absolutely nothing. I think that it's kind of like if we go stand out at the beach and open our hands, the sun shines down. And if everybody opens their hands, there's absolutely enough light to shine on everybody's palms. I didn't do anything to earn that. All I did was do the work of opening my hands. And that's so much like what I've done here. I just am doing the work. And I have been regenerated or made anew. Absolutely. I am not that guy that came in crawling into these meetings 28 years ago. I'm just not that person. Sanctification, I didn't know what that meant. So I looked that up further along in the dictionary, and it means to be set free. Doesn't that tell you, I mean, isn't that what you've done for me? You have made me anew and set me free. I want to thank you for my life. Thank you.